Welcome back to another edition of One True Pod, now on the Andy Staples and Friends feed. Hopefully you found us over here. If you've been a loyal One True Pod listener, thank you for making the jump. If you haven't listened to our podcast, One True Pod, the Athletics Big 12 podcast for now, you can listen. You can still find those previous episodes on the One True Pod feed on Apple or wherever you get your podcast, where we talk about certainly the crisis in the Big 12 and everything else that's been going on this summer. But here we are, fellas. Good to see you. I'm joined as always by Jason Kersey, our Oklahoma expert, and Sam Kahn Jr., our techspert. So good morning, fellas.
Oklahoma expert doesn't quite roll off the tongue the same way, does it? Unfortunately.
Oakspert?
Oakspert. I like Oakspert.
Oakiespert.
Okay.
Yeah.
Right, we can go with that.
We probably could workshop that a little bit. How are you guys doing today?
I'm good man. Just chugging along, getting ready for football season. We're only a few weeks away now. It's August 12th. We got, 16 days till the first actual game, till week zero, and then we've got another week after that until we get to week one when the season starts in mass. So I'm super excited.
Yeah.
It feels weird to me. Like, it feels like I haven't really, maybe just because of all the craziness that's gone on in this conference in the past 3 weeks or so, I haven't really wrapped my head around the idea of, like, there's about to be college football games on TV here pretty soon. Like, just how's covering camp been for you guys? Because I feel like you've gotten deep into that, and I'm still, like, I'm still stuck out here covering the chaos. How's camp been so far?
Well, I mean, from the Oklahoma side, yesterday we got to watch, 20 minutes of stretching and individual drills, which was a great, nice little return to normalcy. You know, I mean, you don't learn a lot really from those things. I think they're mostly for photographers, but it was just nice because that is something that is usually the signal of it, that it's all beginning. And this year we got to do it just like we got to do Big 12 Media Days. It's like, okay, we might actually have a relatively normal season now. Not that COVID's gone, but it's just nice to be that close to the players and that, in that sort of setting. At least that's my my feel on it.
Yeah, no doubt.
Yeah, it was like Jason over at Texas. We got the same setup. It's stretch and first 20-30 minutes. But on Sunday, I was able to go to Texas A&M and had the full open practice experience. So, sit out there for a couple hours and hang out and watch, and you actually get to learn stuff. So, even just watching guys run around you haven't seen in a while, you can see whose guys' bodies have changed and who's got some burst and some wiggle and things like that. So it's really helpful to just go out and see people and talk to people. I spend a lot of time on the sidelines at those practices talking to people around the team, so you get to learn a little bit more about what's going on. So those have been helpful experiences, and it's a really nice, after the realignment bonanza, it has been a really nice adjustment for me to go back and say, hey, this is actually what we're covering is the football part.
I don't know if...
Yeah, it's just...
Sorry, Max.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say, I don't know if Texas has the same policy, but OU has basically said, the players and Lincoln talked about the SEC stuff on Media Day last week, and they're not answering those questions anymore. And honestly, I'm okay with it because I don't really know what they can say. And I'm kind of, it's like, let's talk about football. That's at least where I'm at.
I don't honestly think the current players really care that much, because I think most of the current players don't even know when it's going to happen, if they're even going to play in the league. I mean, certainly your seniors are probably not going to play in the SEC. And then at Texas, Bijan Robinson, he's a sophomore. Maybe he will. Maybe he'll play, but if his career goes like it should, he's probably out after next year, after 2022. It's something that I think – it'll be there. It'll be a subtext. And I wrote a little bit this morning in an essay about Texas-Arkansas game. Texas is going to Arkansas in week two and how there's going to be that subtext. Now, like, it was always going to be a raucous atmosphere because Arkansas-Texas, and we know the old Arkansas fans still consider Texas to be their biggest rival. And so the atmosphere for that game is going to be huge. But now the SEC news adds another layer to that game, because I'm sure at Arkansas or wherever else Texas travels, there's going to be cat calls and SEC chants, and the fans are going to have fun with it.
Let's not forget that Texas made Brett Bielema feel borderline erotic.
Oh, you better believe I used that quote in the story.
Yeah, and he had some good ones with Texas Tech too. I remember that'll be. Yeah, that's Good poll, Jason. Good poll. You know, it does feel a little weird to me. Like, I feel like the, you know, usually we would be like at this point in the year on August 12th, we would be exhausted of all of the sort of preseason storylines and, like, you know, what you're covering, Sam, with the quarterback battles at Texas and Texas A&M and all that kind of stuff. But there's just been like so many headlines that have stacked on top of this. It feels like that, like, one of these days we will have a podcast previewing this Big 12 season, hopefully soon. But it just, like, there's just all these things that seem to be taking priority right now. And I think you got to start with what happened, you know, on Wednesday in Waco. And Sam, you wrote quite about this yesterday. The 5-year investigation of Baylor by the NCAA finally wrapped up. You know, minor penalties, ultimately. No bowl ban, no scholarship reductions, no show cause for Art Briles. Not the kind of severe hammer that I think probably a lot of people expected that Baylor would get based on the severity of what went on there. And instead, the NCAA infractions committee determined that it's not their job to punish sexual assault scandals. That's not their jurisdiction. So I guess let's start there, Sam. What was your reaction when you see the release finally from the NCAA after, obviously, we've covered this for 5 years and this cloud has hung over Baylor this whole time, to actually see that outcome? How did it hit you?
I wasn't shocked. Let's be honest, the NCAA hasn't set a high standard for itself. It hasn't set high expectations for us who know it and follow it. I don't think I was expecting them to do a ton. And part of it is because we are so far removed from the actual time frame that this occurred. Dave Aranda's program is going to have some punishment in terms of recruiting violations. But to me, that's part of the ridiculousness of it, is we're punishing Dave Aranda's program with recruiting violations for something that happened under Art Briles more than 5 years ago. In some cases, some of these instances happened 10 years ago in 2011.
A decade ago. Yeah.
And to me, that just shines how inefficient and how ridiculous the NCAA's pace is on these types of things, especially in this particular instance. I mean, the last hearings were done in December, so we're delivering the decision 8 months after the last hearings, where we're on December 14th and 15th in regards to this case. And so that's frustrating. I don't think I expected them to do a ton to the university. I was shocked that really nothing was done to Briles, and the NCAA's explanation was, well, the campus culture of non-reporting of sexual assault and interpersonal violence was so rampant that we can't say the athletes or the football players benefited or got an impermissible benefit and special treatment because it was so pervasive across the campus. And so I understand the logic, even if I don't agree with it. And my question is if the NCAA cannot punish programs for this, who are no doubt doing it for a competitive advantage, then what are you there for?
As we read in the report, the NCAA is much more comfortable punishing the payment of parking fines. That's their lane. They're good at that gotcha stuff on the little ticky-tack violations, and that's some of the penalties that Baylor is dealing with from you know, the results of this. But so, you know, it's to me, it is. And look, I've through covering this at ESPN and here, like, I have tried hard for 5 years to just, like, leave my opinion out of it, because obviously this is a very complicated and dark story with a lot of layers to it, a lot we still don't know. But it is a little bit baffling to spend 5 years on something that at the start you could have said, this is not an NCAA matter, that you know, this is not something that we have precedent or support to actually prosecute. And I think that while it is understandable, it is, when you actually think about it, it is kind of outrageous, this idea of there was no extra benefits given to student athletes because there was no accountability for anybody. And there was no lack of institutional control because in the rule book, lack of institutional control is about athletics department. And while there was clearly a total lack of institutional control, if that's a campus-wide problem, then the NCAA says, well, we can't really call that an athletics problem. It's just that argument by the Baylor lawyers, it's kind of stunning. I mean, I get it, but it's kind of stunning that actually worked.
It's getting off on a technicality is essentially what it is. I think we all know what happened there. We all know the responsibility that people hold, especially Art Briles and his program, for allowing it to happen and turning a blind eye. I mean, the things that stuck out to me when I read some of the things in the report, because also, of course, Briles, you know, through his attorney, is over here doing a victory lap claiming that he's exonerated. But the report said that he lacked even the most basic human emotion and behavior that you would expect with behavior of this nature, criminal conduct from his players, and that Baylor straight up admitted to the moral and ethical failings that Briles himself, the NCAA 7-member panel, said that head coaches are held to a higher standard, and he failed to meet that standard. And I think that's very telling about, you know, his incurious attitude is the way they put it. His incurious attitude toward potential criminal conduct by his student athletes was deeply troubling to the panel. As a campus leader, the head coach is held to an even higher standard. He completely failed to meet this standard. That's the conclusion that the panel reached. And
then from there, they say in each of these instances, but there's nothing we can do about it.
Right. Exactly. And so it's frustrating. But at the same time, I will say this about the entire thing. I applaud Linda Livingstone, the Baylor president, and Mac Rhodes, the athletic director, yesterday for the way they handled it. They stood up there and answered questions, even though this is something that occurred before they even got there. They have nothing really to do with it. They have been a big part of trying to turn the image of this university and turn the behavior. Dave Aranda, in the first 10 seconds of him speaking to reporters yesterday after practice, showed more empathy for the survivors of this assault than Art Briles ever has. And, you know, mentioned that he had his first thought when he heard the penalties were coming down, that his thoughts were on them and what they've endured. So I think the way they've handled it in the aftermath, I think, should be commended. It seems like, from all accounts that we can tell, that they have done a better job of shifting the culture, both as a football program and as a university. It brings a little bit of closure, at least from a Baylor University standpoint, to a really dark chapter in its history.
Jason, what was your response to this yesterday in seeing this, the conclusion of this investigation?
I'm just sort of interested in the argument that there's nothing they can do. I mean, it was not 10 years ago that an off the field criminal thing caused Penn State to be completely demolished as a program. And I know that maybe they backed off of that a little bit, but I mean, they got that punishment handed down within a year. Like, before the next season, after that story broke, they had been banned from bowls, they had their scholarships reduced, all of that stuff had happened. So I guess I just don't understand how they distinguished those two things. Was it because that was an entirely athletic department problem and not a university-wide problem? Was it because children were involved? I mean, I really, like, I don't know how they distinguish between those two things.
No, I think it's good that you bring that up, because I think that the precedent set with that one is that after the penalties didn't go well for the NCAA in terms of the fight that they had to put up to defend it and ultimately relent on part of it. And I think the sense is that the NCAA did not take a more severe approach here, probably because they feel that they would get sued and they would lose. As the North Carolina case sort of set some precedent recently, you could make the argument, look, this is not an NCAA matter. You know, that this is a university matter. And so, I'm sure there's a lot of frustration, even within the NCAA, the people who probably put in the work to investigate this, to see the people that's their job to prosecute it, say we can't really make a case here. But as you wrote last night, Sam, it does sort of, this is hitting at a very interesting time where Mark Emmert is saying we need to rethink and reform the NCAA. Clearly to be as toothless as they are, right now, as they head into this moment where they need to rethink all of it, how do you think that sort of we move forward from this? Do you think that the right thing to do is to modify this so that there is actual language about sexual violence and partner violence and gender violence and all that? Or do they need to just stay out of this?
I think that's really up to them. I think if you are going to purport to be an organization that's about more than just running championships, running a basketball tournament, and hitting athletes and coaches for ticky-tack violations that don't really have a lot to do with the integrity of the game. If you're going to purport to be more than that, then yeah, I think you should install some type of governance structure that allows you to punish for discretions like this one. Because again, why else would football coaches, and I'm not even just talking about Baylor, I'm talking about any football program, why do some coaches and some programs turn the other cheek when there's bad behavior by their players? It's because they want to win games. It's allowing your players to play so that you can win games and so that you can keep everything going. And that's why we have these situations that happen in this way, because football carries so much importance in the college structure. So if you're going to be the governing body for it, then I think you should have some role in legislating that, because it does actually impact the game. It does actually impact the entire power structure. That said, if you want to be just an organization that just runs championships and stays out of the way otherwise, I guess that's fine. That's something they have to contend with. That's something they have to decide. And I think, again, I wrote this in my piece, but I think this is coming at a time that makes sense, is that the NCAA, with this constitutional committee they launched, they're going to look at these major changes and they've got to figure out a different governance structure. I think even we've had this talk with the realignment stuff with Texas and OU, is with football alone, which the NCAA doesn't really have a ton of control over, at least not at the FBS level, I think it's time for a major governance structure change in the NCAA.
I just would also add, and I know we touched on it a little bit, but I mean, Art Briles should never coach again. And the idea that he's running around acting like he's been exonerated is so embarrassing and awful. I mean, it's not just that he overlooked all those things and didn't report them. It's that he has displayed no remorse for it at all. And I don't know. I just... That's the part I can't get past with the NCAA punishment, because on one hand, I can almost understand like saying, okay, well, they've completely cleaned house. There's a new president. There's a new AD. They're on their second new football coach since then. Okay, we're not going to bring the hammer down on Baylor as an institution, but Art Briles should never coach again in college or anywhere. And I just can't believe that they could say all the things that they said about how he behaved and then go, well, sorry, nothing we can do. There is something they could do about him, right?
It certainly felt like from the way they wrote it that the people on that committee would like to hand down a severe show cause penalty there, and to give out a 5-year show cause to a behind the scenes staffer, I mean, which to me didn't totally make a whole lot of sense. Clearly, I think there was a thirst there to actually do something like that to Briles, but they couldn't talk themselves into it, which is it's gonna be fascinating to see if as his agent says, if this is this provides Art Briles the opportunity to coach in college again. I don't know. I think anybody who reads the report would not come to the same conclusion that the Art Briles camp did.
Yeah. Well, I can't imagine that anybody. Well, I take that back. Of course, I can imagine that somebody's going to try to hire him. They already have tried to hire him at Southern Miss. So we'll see what happens. But I hope he never coaches again, because he shouldn't.
I think his strategy is going to be trying to run out the clock essentially and get enough distance from this to hope that everyone forgets and moves on. And that whatever school may try to hire him is probably going to just try to withstand the backlash and hope that it can. Whether or not we get to that point, I don't know. I would say a few years ago that I thought he was going to return the college game at some point, and that someone would roll the dice and try to withstand the backlash. But I don't know. Now, after this and in the last couple of years, after he left Mount Vernon and didn't get a job after that, I'm starting to wonder if he's now been removed from the game for 5-6 years. He's 65. I mean, there's still, obviously he's got the passion to do it and all that, but I'm skeptical now. I'm starting to think that it won't happen. And I wrote it in my column. It's Art has been very transparent about who he is. He cares about football and that's about it. And I think that speaks volumes about who he is. But like I said, I can't imagine another attempt to hire him would go much differently than the Southern Miss one did. But we shall see. It'll be interesting to watch.
Yeah, yeah. Well, bumpy transition here. Why don't we move on to the state of the Big 12? You know, certainly not a whole lot of big moves going on this week. Not on the level of what we saw last week with Bob Bolesby going to meet with the Pac-12 commissioner George Kliavkoff. But you know, from my reporting, the sense is that meeting went well. That Bob Bolesby came away optimistic about the potential of a partnership in some fashion with the Pac-12. I think there's not a lot of details hammered out there, but certainly a couple different ideas and creative solutions that they've discussed. Now we'll see if the Pac-12 wants to go in different directions with other conferences, but there seem to be positive you know sort of reviews on that. But you know the Pac-12 side of it is a whole different deal in terms of what their needs are. You know, as we reported on Monday, in our piece on kind of what's next in the Big 12, you've got the three Texas schools working very closely together and looping in Oklahoma State as well. Certainly being betrayed by Texas has brought those schools together to share information and talk every day. And, we'll see if the Pac-12 decides maybe they'd rather, you know, pursue just those schools. What do you think of that concept, Sam, of, you know, we've talked already about how, you know, individually, it seems like each of these Big 12 schools is having a hard time kind of making the case to other leagues that we individually bring a lot of value to your conference. But do you think that bundling up the three Texas schools and potentially throwing in an Oklahoma State, does that do anything for the Pac-12, you think? Does that make sense as a backup plan for these schools?
I think it makes more sense than adding one of them. If the Pac-12 were to look at like Texas Tech and Oklahoma State, for instance, I don't know that makes more sense than keeping those three Texas schools together, because if you're going to go ahead and plant your flag in Texas, you might as well try to get your money's worth out of it. And I think Texas Tech, Baylor, and TCU have more value together than they do individually in realignment. And then I think if you were able to bring Oklahoma State with them, that's a four pretty solid athletic programs. And we're talking a TCU football team that's been pretty good historically. We're talking about a Baylor football program that has been in a basketball program that won a national championship, Texas Tech program that's been there. Oklahoma State has been a model of consistency under the Mike Gundy era, and they're also a pretty solid basketball program and first-class facilities. So I think those schools all do – those four together make a lot of sense for anybody. I do think they do add value. I think the question is, just like all the realignment questions, is it enough value to increase everybody else's payouts in the Big 12? If it is, it's something they do. If not, then it's not. But I don't think it's a futile enterprise to at least explore adding those four schools.
Well, it's funny because you hear the Pac-12 folks say, oh, you know, we want sort of members within our footprint that sort of fit us in a lot of ways. But you look at those four Big 12 schools, are they really that different from Colorado and Utah and the last members they brought in? I mean, I think there's probably bigger brands overall than those schools. And Colorado and Utah have also had success in Pac-12 football since, you know, in this decade since joining that league. So I don't think that they've held that conference back at all. So yeah, I'm with you. I think it's going to be interesting. Certainly don't know what the timetable is on that kind of a concept of how quickly does the Pac-12 want to move their TV deals up in 2024, whereas the Big 12s is up in 2025. Obviously, the grant of rights is, you know, trapping all these schools to stay together here. And you know, what does it take to dissolve that is still very unclear. But I think it's an interesting possibility. And then, you know, certainly part of that, the whole Pac-12 talk that is curious is, what about West Virginia? And we've talked about them on this podcast before. But, you know, from my reporting there, their point of view is, you know, they don't know if the ACC offer is going to come. They don't know if that's going to be on the table. And so right now you have to continue to operate as a member of the Big 12 saying, hey, we're in this together. If you're going to talk to the Pac-12, don't leave us out of it. You know, hopefully West Virginia can benefit from a revenue standpoint if you make that kind of a partnership or merger or whatever, while hopefully having a minimal role from a travel standpoint. Now, obviously, you know, that's just super inconvenient. I think everyone in the Big 12 understands it doesn't make sense for West Virginia to you know, have to deal with these challenges of being tied to the Pac-12 as an East Coast school. Could you picture that, Jason? Would that be funny to see West Virginia, you know, playing a night game at Wazoo?
Yeah, that's exactly what I was about to say, actually, was like a West Virginia at Washington State or Washington State at West Virginia game in conference.
Yeah.
We've got to stop naming conferences based on geography or numbers. It's just that needs to go away. We should just rename all the conferences. But I completely agree with what you said about, you know, Colorado and Utah are pretty good examples of that. Those level of schools can be successful, and the Pac-12 can add value, can be beneficial. And I to kind of piggyback on a little bit of what Sam was saying, I think there's probably a ton of value for the Pac-12 in getting into the state of Texas. I mean, at that point, you'd have the SEC and the Pac-12 in Texas. I mean, that's probably great for recruiting. It's great for TV eyeballs. I mean, all those things are probably good. So, I do wonder what effect that will have on Pac-12 After Dark, if it will have any effect on that. but
it's interesting to get into a different time zone for that conference. And obviously you've seen the pushback, like, you know, Stanford is coming to Dallas to play, to play Kansas State to open the year. And David Shaw is mad that they got, you know, the body clock game there at 11 a.m. or 12 a.m. or whatever. So I'm sure there's some resistance from that side of it in terms of how does this make sense for us? But look, you know, if you add the University of Texas, then that gives you the state of Texas from a market standpoint, right? That's the only one that's sort of like you can say, yeah, that actually is doing something for us. But so the SEC is obviously going to, you know, kind of dominate the state of Texas from an eyeballs and TV standpoint. But I do think there's value of getting the three. I think that there are seriously passionate fan bases that would provide value there. I know that Baylor and TCU are smaller alumni bases, but
yeah,
I kind of think it makes sense. And I think that the thing that this all kind of hinges on is just how patient are people willing to be, because sitting here right now saying, oh, we'll figure this out in 3-4 years. I think for some members of the Big 12, there you just get itchy, right? You just say like, we can't be living in this uncertainty and this stress and the sky is falling for this long a time. And so does that motivate any members of the Big 12 to go to a George Kliefkoff, for example, and say, hey, we want to be part of this. What do we got to do? Now, I don't know how that all shakes out in terms of timetable and granted rights and all that, but I can see some people just having a hard time. As much as everyone wants to preach unity and say, you know, the eight of us are more valuable together if we're united, I can see some sides just saying, we got to do something before we, you know, and be proactive so that we don't get left behind and end up in a group of five conference.
I mean, Oklahoma and Texas are in the best positions financially and everything relative to the rest of the Big 12. And they were thinking about their own futures and they were planning and scheming and all those things. And again, they're in a much better position than some of these other schools are. So totally, you've got to look out for yourself. Absolutely. And I know that basketball isn't the top consideration here, but it would be fun. I mean, Baylor and Texas Tech are two programs that have been to Final Fours in the last few years in basketball. Oklahoma State's got a really solid basketball program. I think they've got a good future with Boynton there. They just had the number one overall pick. I mean, those schools playing basketball in the Pac-12 with UCLA and Arizona and the like could be really fun as well.
I agree. And I want to say, like, as a disclaimer, like, cause I get this feedback a lot and it's not the happiest feedback. When we talk about this stuff, there's a tendency to not talk about Kansas State, Iowa State. And I don't want to freak people out. I'm not trying to say those three are doomed. Nobody's talking about them. Nobody wants them. That's not the case at all. I do think it's just the conversation has trended towards the Texas schools in West Virginia because I think there's sort of like more logical fits out there that I think are worth discussing right now. The problem I think for those other three schools is that it seems like the Big Ten is not very motivated right now. From all the reporting we've done and everything we've heard, the Big Ten is not motivated to go poach these schools. And I'm not saying that can't ever happen. I'm never going to say never on this stuff. This stuff it's a very fluid process. And certainly if the Pac-12 does something, I think that could topple some dominoes and suddenly there is a demand for the rest of these Big 12 schools, for example. But right now, if the Big Ten's sitting on the sideline, it's a little bit harder to see some destination for those three schools right now that would emerge. And that's why I think for those three, it's still the priority is still to stay together, that the eight of us are more valuable than the, you know, just a faction of three or four. And I think they have to continue to kind of hang on to that. But I'm not saying anything's doomed there. I don't want to freak out those fan bases who, because there's a tendency I see in all this to everyone wants to sort of tell themselves, oh, our school's actually really valuable and we're not being talked about enough, we're being undervalued, there's going to be suitors. And I'm not saying that can't be the case, but you just got to buckle up. This stuff is just going to take a long time and it's going to take patience. And I apologize if you felt snubbed in these conversations. That is certainly not been the intent of our coverage. And you guys know, I mean, if you were a diehard fan of one of those three schools, Kansas State, Iowa State, I'm sure it's maddening right now that you're getting, you know, you're getting all this mixed feedback, and you're getting this sense that, well, wait a minute, or, you know, what if we're not in a Power Five league? What if we are getting left behind? I'm sure it's infuriating.
And I feel bad for, I mean, I feel really bad for all three of those schools, like you said, but especially I feel like Iowa State, I mean, they have really finally gotten to where they're really good at football. I mean, they are a top 10 team in the coaches poll this week that came out. They appear to have a legitimate chance to win the Big 12 this year. And yeah, it really sucks for them and their fans that this is all happening just as they've started to finally, a fan base that 100% deserves the success that they're finally enjoying has to also deal with this crap on the side. That just stinks all around.
It does.
And this is part of the thing that's disheartening about realignment in general, is because, and I always go back to it, but I think back to the Southwest Conference breakup in 94-95 and Houston, TCU, SMU, and Rice that got left in the wilderness. TCU, of course, found its way back, but that has really big repercussions on athletic programs. So the fear for any of these schools in the Big 12 of getting left out of a power conference and not being a have and instead getting relegated to the have-nots is real, and because it has a lasting impact on your athletic department long-term and what you can do and what your ceiling is. And Jason, I feel bad for the Iowa States of the world that who have a really loyal fan base that shows out for its games even when it's not a good team. Even Kansas State. I mean, Kansas State's been one of the best home game atmospheres that I've been to. So it's unfortunate, and I hope that all these places find a good home.
Agreed. Manhattan, Kansas is one of my favorite road trips that I go on. I love it there. I think yeah, their stadium isn't the biggest, but God, it's so loud in there.
For sure. And, you know, I'm very curious to see, you know, another thing we touched on in the story on Monday is just the hurt feelings and the real, like the real visceral anger that still is very present at the surface for everyone in the Big 12 towards Texas and Oklahoma. And as Bob Bowlesby told me, it's really tough to get betrayed by people that you consider your close friends, you know, in the cases of the ADs there, and that he still feels they did this as deceptively as they possibly could. And look, there's nothing that Texas and Oklahoma can say or do that sort of smooths that out, right? You just kind of have to take that hit and keep it moving and go off to the SEC. It's like a breakup, right? There's just going to be that part of it where the other side, the scorn side, says, here's all the stuff you did to me. Here's all the reasons why you're the bad guy in all this, and you just gotta deal with it. What has that been like? You know, I think we all know that Texas is used to being perceived as the villain, and as we saw, you know, Jay Hartzell talked to the Texas Senate Committee last week, Sam. He was very comfortable in that. It taking all those arrows, he was totally fine with it, confident that, you know, we got to take these hits, but we know what we're doing. Is it weird, Jason, for Oklahoma, with how respected, you know, Joe C is, and how respected just this whole athletic department is? I know that it's not something they're probably talking about in interviews and stuff like that there, but has it been weird to see that on social and stuff like that, that Oklahoma is now kind of villainized too?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's been a big piece of this that I think has been sort of I don't know if surprising is the right word.
And you can say unfairly, right? You can say, hey, they've carried this conference for years.
Yeah.
It's not their job to subsidize all these schools.
Sure.
They're doing what's best for them. You know, you can throw out that defense. I'm not saying that's, invalid or anything.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's what they did is justifiable when they're thinking about their own future, but absolutely. Joe Castiglione, you got to remember, I mean, this is a guy who is a senior athletic director nationwide. I mean, he's widely considered to be one of the best, if not the best, athletic director in college athletics. He's got friends everywhere, all over the conference. People trust him. I think you may have reported this, that Bob Bowlsby considered him to be a very good friend. Yep. I mean, he served on the basketball.
One source told me that this whole thing has been very un-Joe-like, the way that it went down.
Yeah, I mean, Joe Castiglione was on the basketball selection committee. He's on the playoff committee now. He's been on the baseball committee. I mean, this is a man with connections and friends everywhere. And yep. I thought that really shined through in the Regents meeting a couple weeks ago, because like you said, the OU administration is pretty well clammed up. They're not talking about this much, but they did speak publicly, both Castiglione and Joe Harris, about that they know what impact this is having on everybody else, and they don't love it. I mean, and even sort of in conversations with other sources off the record, I'm getting the impression that this stuff is really, it bothers Joe how he's being perceived. Yeah. But the truth is he probably knew that this was going to happen. And I think it's probably the same for Joe Harris. I mean, Joe Harris has only been the OU president now for a couple of years, but he was part of the formation of the Big 12. He was the OU general counsel in the mid 90s, all the way up until, 2007, 2008. I mean, he's got friends and relationships with people all over the conference too. I think it absolutely is a thing, and it's probably bothering them. And I think it's probably going to be super awkward until OU leaves for the SEC.
One piece of feedback I got after that story came out Monday was that I maybe undersold how much people in the Big 12 are pissed at Texas and Oklahoma. And that, even within that conference, they don't want to see Oklahoma versus Texas in the Big 12 title game this year. Like they don't want these schools representing this league, even though you want them to stay through 25, like you see, Chris Delcani is taken off the college football playoff committee as the Big 12 rep and replaced by Gene Taylor from K-State. Like, there's going to be this awkwardness as long as they're in here, where it's like, we don't want to hand you the trophies. We don't want to celebrate you within this conference. And I don't know if that's actually going to show up on game days at all. I don't think players care that much about. I think they already hate Texas and they already get up for playing Oklahoma. But do you guys think that's just going to be kind of just a weird undercurrent throughout this whole season? Just that disdain for these two schools now?
I think from a fan standpoint, when those two schools go on the road, without question, I think you'll hear from the fans. I don't think the players, it's going to matter that much. Like I said earlier, for most of these players are not going to end up playing in the SEC. These are two programs they get up to play anyway every week. Everybody wants to beat Oklahoma because Oklahoma is the Big 12 reigning champion, and everybody wants to beat Texas.
And everyone knows they can beat Texas.
Right. Yeah. Everybody wants to beat Texas because it's Texas. So I think the fan reception is where we're going to see the atmosphere. I think that's where we're going to see the tension and a little bit of awkwardness is that part.
Last thing here, Jason, you wrote a great piece that's up on The Athletic today. I thought was a really interesting sort of window into another element of this summer that's just a whole new world, and that is, name, image, and likeness. And you went to Chicago to tail Spencer Rattler as he went to an autograph signing, a big-time autograph signing. And, this guy is... in terms of perception, in terms of like what Open Door says, has the potential to be the highest earner of anybody out there in terms of college athletes, thanks to NIL rights. So take the listener through that experience of hitting the road with Rattler and seeing what it's like to have this sort of big time college athlete, still super young guy. Jump into kind of starting his business here.
Yeah, it was wild, because first of all, I'd never been to anything like this convention. It's the National Sports Collectors Convention in this huge convention center. Thousands of people, all these dealers selling old baseball cards, memorabilia. I mean, it was super cool. Like, I honestly, as I was leaving, I thought I could like come back here with my dad and my brother and we would have like the best time ever. Like, it was really a cool event. But you get over to the autograph section, and yeah, I mean, you're talking about Emmett Smith, Barry Sanders, and Pudge Rodriguez were all three there signing on the same day as Spencer Rattler. That's three Hall of Famers. You know, Ric Flair was there. Hulk Hogan was there. Just on down the list. I think I counted that it, throughout the 4 or 5 day event, six of the top 10 rushers in NFL history signed at this thing.
Wow.
And so did the quarterback of Oklahoma. And it was very interesting. He probably wasn't the most popular guy there, but that's to be expected. I mean, he's still not in the NFL. He still has only started one season. He didn't, it's not like he won the Heisman last year or anything. So, but there were a lot of people there that, I got the impression thought of this as an investment. $150 for a Spencer Rattler autograph. Yeah, that may not be too big of a price to pay in another year or two. So, so that was interesting. At one point, cause I was sort of embedded with him throughout the day. And at one point we're in the back cause he did a public signing. Then he signed just stacks of jerseys, helmets, in the back. And at one point we're all sitting back there and the curtain swings open and Emmett Smith walked in to come say hello to Spencer Rattler and also sort of just marvel. I mean, while they were talking, Emmett sort of marveled at the fact that he could do this. I mean, Emmett Smith was a superstar at Florida in the late 80s. What could he have made doing, you know, ads and stuff when he was in college? And he sort of alluded to that. And so, it was a really fun experience. And the other thing, you know, watching Spencer Rattler, again, the quarterback of Oklahoma, we just live in such a different world now. He's walking around basically with an entourage. I mean, he's got his girlfriend with him. He's got his agent with him, who is also Patrick Mahomes' agent. And he's got, his exclusive memorabilia dealer. It was just a weird, good for him. It's great that he's able to take advantage of this, but, it was an interesting thing. And, you know, talking to some autograph experts and things like that. One other message that I really was told a lot by a lot of people was, this is great for the autograph industry because that stuff is shady and it has been shady for decades going back in terms of college athletes, you know, sneaking into hotel rooms or doing it very secretly, unless you're Johnny Manziel and bringing it out into the light and making the whole industry a little bit more legitimate. That was also sort of an interesting side of it, but it was a great experience. And I really hope people will read it because I think it's an interesting sort of peek into what this world is now, because I can pretty much guarantee you that next year at the National Sports Collectors Convention, there will not be only one college athlete there.
You know, and that's what's interested me so much is you watch this play out and we're only like a month and a half into this whole new era here. And a year from now, like people are going to be doing this a lot smarter and they're going to be making, I'm sure, a lot more money. But you still kind of have this early iteration of it where people are trying stuff, seeing what's worth it, seeing what's not. You've got, players like I saw the Ohio State's big freshman. He partnered up with a car dealership and got a car and all that. And like you kind of have these early deals that are sort of setting the tone for here's how much you can benefit or whatever. So I agree with you. I think you're going to see a lot more of that next year. One thing that you see, I'm sure you see it in the comments of that story. You're going to see it on Twitter. You hear it from Lincoln Riley. You hear it from all sorts of folks is there's still kind of reflexively, there's this little bit of wincing where people are like, you know, hopefully he's still focused on the season. Hopefully he's still focused on getting better and training and that that he's going to make more money if they win a title this year. He should be focused on winning the title and that's where you make your bones, right? So what, after watching that and making your own assessment of how engaged or not engaged Spencer Rattler is in his primary responsibility, like how would you respond to people on that? Because it does seem like I do think fans and probably coaches too are going to have to just sort of get used to that. And sometimes they'll probably be right. There probably will be players that are too locked in on it and not so much on improving. But I do think people are, it seems like a little uncomfortable with that initially just because this stuff is new.
Yeah, and I think that's sort of natural, but I would say as far as Spencer Rattler goes, now obviously I'm not with him 24 hours a day. I was with him for 4 hours on this one day.
Yeah.
And obviously he's not going to tell me if it's affecting his preparation, but I don't think it is. And the reason I don't think it is because, I talked to his private QB trainer, Mike Giovando, a guy out in Phoenix who he's worked with since he was in eighth grade. And, he sort of told me the story of, you know, he flew from that event in Chicago back to Phoenix for about 4 days to be at home before coming back for the start of fall camp. And he flew out there and he met up with his QB guru and he worked on throws. And he now the interesting thing, though, is he did all that. And there was a camera crew out there shooting an ad. But what his coach told me was, but that was a real workout. It wasn't like a fake thing that they did for the cameras. It was a real workout. And he really was out there working, even as he was filming an ad with Terrell Owens at the same time. So it's sort of interesting how this is going to work. But, I mean, it sounds like he's got a good team around him. He certainly has a good team around him. He's got Patrick Mahomes' agent working for him. You can't really get much better than that. And so I think he's got a good team around him. I think that he is motivated to be good. I think he's motivated to win the Heisman, whether he'll say that or not. I do think the Heisman is something that he aspires to. I think being the first overall pick is something that he aspires to. And those things won't happen if he lets NIL get in the way. And that's another point that his private QB guru also said is that, you know, we get 5 or 6 months down the road, NIL stuff will be small potatoes, and he needs to keep that in mind. And I think he is. Now, we'll see. We'll see if it affects things, but I maybe I'm being naive here, but I don't think it will any more than, you know, Patrick Mahomes doing commercials in Kansas City while also quarterbacking the Chiefs. I don't see it being a problem, but, you know, maybe it will. I don't know.
I don't think it's an issue. Let's be honest. When training camp starts, which it has, and when the season starts, which it will soon, everybody's to be doing football. No one's going to be leaving practice, or skipping practice to shoot a commercial. Let's be real.
Can you imagine? Can you imagine?
Yeah, that's not going to happen. It's funny. I was watching last night the Netflix documentary about the Malice in the Palace, and I forgot that Ron Artest asked for some time off to go promote his album back in 2004. So we're not going
to
have that situation.
I'll have to watch that.
I know it's really good. We're not going to have that situation in college football. And honestly, these guys have enough free time. Guys and girls have enough free time in the off season, because of hours limits. And remember, let's not forget the NCAA has hours limits, only a 20-hour limit during the season and the off season. Like if you're in summer strength conditioning in football, it's only 8. So, yes, they need to spend their time doing what they need to do to get ready for their seasons and do their academics and all that stuff. But I don't think it's going to be that big of an issue. I think people underestimate how sharp these young men and women are. I think we've seen a lot of them in early stages of the NIL, how creative and sharp some of them are and how savvy some of them are from a business standpoint. I think this is a great, great training ground and learning ground for these, especially the ones who are going to become professionals, because it's great lessons in money management. It's great lessons in time management and understanding how to leverage yourself and your brand. I think it's fantastic. And while I'm sure it will never go perfectly, I'm sure there will be some hiccups here and there. I think by and large, it's not going to be a big issue.
And if you can pocket 20, 30, 50,000 bucks in a weekend, you know, you can make a year's salary just on a weekend of signing stuff. Yeah. Do it. I mean, don't do it during your bye week, I wouldn't think, during the season. But I mean, who's to say that this is not absolutely worth their time, and that a guy like Spencer Rattler has earned that. Jason, was it interesting to you to just sort of not just witness this, but just think about when people talk about, you know, Bryce Young having, you know, 800,000, close to a million or whatever. Like, isn't that a little bit wild to think this kid that you've covered since he was in high school, to see that, you know what happens when they go pro, but to see that already kind of occur, I know it did with Kyler too, but to see that already occur before he goes play and plays his second, you know, his second full season, to have that possibility of, can you get to 500,000? Can you get to a million? Something like that. I mean, it is good for him, but like it is kind of wild to see this first round of these guys capitalize on it.
You mentioned the Kyler thing. I'd sort of forgotten. Obviously, that was different. He had signed a baseball contract, but it is sort of interesting to think that if you know, he capitalizes as much as he possibly can, there's a chance that two of the last three OU starting quarterbacks could have been millionaires on their own while they were in college. That's pretty interesting.
Jalen Hurts would have made good money. For sure,
no, he would have, but I'm saying Kyler did, and Spencer might.
Yeah.
So yeah, we live in a completely different world now with this stuff. It was weird to watch because you're just not used to seeing. I mean, Spencer Rattler can't legally buy a beer until late next month, and he's at this, and he's sitting on a dais, a few seats down from where Emmett Smith was signing autographs. It's very strange, but at the same time, this is what it should be. I mean, this is better. It's better that they can do this. It is weird to see them on Cameo. It's weird to see, few of these other guys doing little things, having their merch stores, that kind of thing. I mean, that's the other thing that I get into in the story. Spencer Rattler also has a merch store, which I know a lot of these guys are doing. And I mean, he hired a graphic designer.
Now, he didn't charge you for the interview, right?
No, he did not. He did not.
On some of these Open Doors profiles, they say, like, I'm available for interviews for pay. So, like, I just want to make sure you didn't pay for this access, Jason.
No, Max, that goes against my ethics as a journalist.
okay.
I I'm pretty sure The Athletic wouldn't have been cool with that either. But no, I did not. But yeah, I mean, that stuff is happening. We're seeing that happen at a lot of other schools. I mean, the media outlets that cover the school signing these deals.
Yeah.
Whether that's a good or certainly bad thing is that's up for individual people to decide, but like it is very, it's wild. It's just totally, totally different.
Jason, do you want to tell people what you bought at this convention?
Sure. I would be proud to, even if you two roll your eyes at me. Yeah. While I was there, I didn't go into it planning to buy anything. Let me just say that up front, but I was walking around and before my interview with Spencer, I happened to walk by this one display where there was a karate gi autographed by Ralph Macchio, and I had to have it. So I purchased it.
Ralph wasn't there.
Wasn't there. Well, if he'd been there, I would have failed in my interview. I just would have been around him the whole time. So
you would have blown off Spencer completely. Yeah,
I would have completely ruined wasted the whole day. No, I did buy it because I love that movie and I love that show that's on now. But I don't have it with me or I'd show it to you. It's actually, I sent it off to Framebridge to be framed. So I'm waiting for it to come back. I went up there and bought something myself. Not anything OU related, okay? I still have my ethics, and I'm still unbiased. But I can be biased about Cobra Kai.
Were they selling any William Zabka stuff, or was it just Macchio?
I didn't see Williams. If I'd seen Zabka, I would have gotten that over Macchio, honestly.
But, oh, okay. Yeah, I didn't know what side you were on there.
I'm Team Johnny, completely. Team Johnny. Okay. But that wasn't available, so... If Ralph Macchio is listening to this podcast, which I'm sure he is, don't be offended. I still bought it. He's a Big 12 fan, I'm sure.
Yeah, well, he probably was, listening to the Andy Staples feed already, and now he's stunned to learn that he's being talked about here. So this is one of the perks of the new spot here. So
he's waiting with bated breath on Big 12 realignment news.
That's right. I'm sure he's a diehard K-State fan wondering what's next. Fellas, I think we've covered plenty today. Appreciate your time. Sam, you were juggling children that entire time. I don't know if the listener could even notice. There may be a little chirp here or there. How are the kids doing?
They're good. They're good. My wife went to go meet a friend for coffee. And so I am stuck being dad.
We were double booked today.
So
yeah.
Adrian, my son, is right here. He's been pretty good. He had a poopy diaper explosion in the middle of the podcast that I had to go take care of. And so I hope nobody noticed that. I've gone for a little while. But and then Christopher's watching TV. I don't even know what he's watching right now. But I have survived and made it through the podcast. So I appreciate
everyone's patience in this regard.
Sam, in about 15 years, he's going to be horrified when he finds this podcast that you talked about his poopy diaper.
That's our parents' charge, right? Is to embarrass our kids at all costs.
There's probably thematically poopy diaper explosion. Probably you could sort of weave that through the topics that we talked about today. Fellas, thank you as always. We will. What do you got, Adrian? What are your thoughts?
You want to say something? Okay. He just ate some blueberries.
That sums awesome. It all up, I think.
All right, fellas. Great talking to you as always. We will be back next week, and we will be publishing these weekly on Thursdays. Thank you so much for listening. We talked about a bunch of stories that are on The Athletic during this podcast. If you're not a subscriber to The Athletic, you can sign up with our latest promotional offer at theathletic.com/onetruepod, where you're going to get comprehensive coverage of Oklahoma, Texas, the future of the Big 12, Baylor, everything else. So now is a great time to sign up, and we will see you next time. Thanks so much. We'll be right back.